Welcome to the BristolCon Fringe, a series of readings from the science fiction and fantasy community. This podcast was recorded in front of a live audience in the centre of Bristol.
It's not often that we genuinely need no introduction, but as far as Cornell is concerned, he will probably hang me from the rafters if I mutter about Wolverine fucking or something. He's got loads of other stuff as well, and this book in particular, I know that he's very proud of something that's been around for a long time, so I will let Paul tell us all about it.
Thank you, Cheryl. This is Chalk, which is out tomorrow, and I've been working on this for about 20 years on and off. It's a very personal book. I finally write an autobiographical novel, and it's horror. it's about growing up in Wiltshire in the 1980s, but I think it's universal. I hope it is anyway. I'm just going to read from the start and then one bit later on. I've been writing many, many drafts of this over a very long period of time. It's gone through many different shapes. So this is it's my most important book. It's the work of my life, and I'm delighted that tomorrow is a kind of finishing line for me. I mean, not in terms of my life. I've got comics to write, you know. This is a major thing for me, and I'm delighted to be here tonight to meet from you. We're talking about the West Country of Great Britain, the farming country below Wales and above Cornwall. Find the county of Wiltshire, then the town of Calne. Move your cursor east for about 2 miles along the A4 road. There's Cheryl Downs. Find some images. On almost all of them will be the Cheryl White Horse. It's one of many hill figures cut from the chalk soil on the uplands in this part of Britain. Some of them are relatively modern, some are ancient. The Uffington horse, further north, is the ancient one everyone knows. That one was cut, so the archaeologists tell us, by the nations of Iron Age people that lived in Wiltshire. The Durotriges, or the Artibates, as the Romans referred to them. They were rich. Their currency took the form of polished axe heads never sharpened. They had vast resources, a large population, and the commitment to build and maintain great monuments. The Uffington design is an indication, we're told, that they caught and tamed wild horses. The archaeologists think it's a model of what the tribes wanted to happen. This animal looks like it's running past, but actually we've captured it on this hillside. The Cheryl White Horse, on the other hand, although it's beside an Iron Age hill fort, was cut in modern times. It looks domesticated. It turns the downs behind it from a forbidding fortress and a place of suffering into the background of a painting. If the sunlight catches it at the right time of day, it's got a twinkle in its eye. It was cut out of the chalk in 1780 on the instructions of one Dr. Christopher Allsop, who lived in Calne. According to the history books, they call Allsop the Mad Doctor. They say he bellowed instructions to the men cutting the chalk from where he stood below the downs in the town of Cheryl. That's why this horse uniquely is designed for perspective, for a modern audience who are used to the illusion of that. I think Allsop suspected something about those downs. Perhaps he decided to put something up there to overwrite it. So the Cheryl White Horse isn't old, but it's said locally that if a woman sits on the eye, originally made of lemonade bottles, she'll get pregnant. Nobody ever said, when I played on those downs as a child, with what, or who's the father? It's like modern people know there's something there, that whatever it is wants to make new life, that it wants to get out. They put the horse there to be that thing, rather than think about what's been buried. The hill fort on Cheryl Downs is now called Oldbury Castle. The archaeological records show that when they heard the Romans were coming, the Iron Age tribes built huge new fortifications. They thought they could resist. There must have come a point when the alarm raised, the legions approaching, they left their villages and evacuated to their stronghold. They would at least go down fighting. The Romans didn't give them the chance. They had their decisive battles elsewhere. Then they built the road that's now the A4 right past the downs. You can imagine the tribes sitting up there, besieged only by themselves, watching the Romans march past. Up close, the walls of that hill fort are like waves rolling through the ground. They're huge. You're hidden when you walk those pitches. The wind drops. You're insulated. If you try to run up the other side, the pebbles of chalk will slide from under your shoes, and you'll have to use your hands, your fingers jamming into the soil for a long clamber, and you'll have to stop when you get to the top, breathing hard, and to see another ditch and another rise in front of you. When I was a small child, there was a copse up there where the sheep sheltered. I would sit there on a fallen tree to catch my breath. I watched the shadows of clouds pass over the big valleys below that were made by glaciers. Or I would go and sit on that first step of the Lansdowne Monument, built in 1845 by Henry Petty Fitzmaurice, of the family who still own the stately home down the A4 past Cowan. That monument is a big spike of white stone. Or I would go and lie in the bowl barrow. It's a depression in the ground outside the bounds of the hill fort in the form of a perfect circle. Before the First World War, everyone said it was where a keep had been built. Then it became where a Zeppelin had dropped a bomb. Then it became where a German bomber had dropped a bomb. But archaeologists tell us it's actually a grave. At the bottom of the bowl, under the soil, lies a person, curled up like they're about to be born, on a bed of flint and charcoal with a knife, a bow, wrist guards and a beaker full of beer. They say it's a loving burial, proof of belief in an afterlife. But I have my doubts. Perhaps the archaeologists weren't looking for the threefold death, the beating around the head, the wound in the throat, the suffocation. Perhaps they considered the stomach contents only in terms of food. You'd still be able to see my family home from there. My parents still live in that house, a bungalow built by my dad. They still have my elderly aunt Dar as their neighbour. Nearby there are a few scattered houses, a couple of villages, Culstone and Blackland, formed out of buildings that happened to lie along the same road. We got a church magazine that covered seven parishes and they went way out into nowhere. The possibilities of the distant Salisbury Plain were always there when I was a child. I would hear thunder on a sunny day and Mum would say that that was the guns firing at the military bases up there, and I would be frightened at how loud they must be close up. Mum would hurry me inside, frightened too, as if the shells were about to start landing all around us. How rich Mum and Dad were varied hugely when I was small. I went from private school to village school to private school. First I was the kid with the stupid accent, then I was the kid with the posh accent, then back again. That back and forth process, in some ways, explains everything. It's like the British class system is a magnetic field, and moving a conductor through it produces current. Every weekday morning, eight of us, kids from Cowan and its surrounding villages, would stand on the town hall steps and wait for the minibus that took us to school in the village of Falsley. We'd be in uniform. Dad would drive me in on his way to work in Lyme. He owned an insurance business that served the RAF base. He once had a laundry in the same building, then a betting shop. The insurance was the only thing that held on. The betting shop seems to have been a failed attempt to turn a passionate hobby into a career, to turn something that lost money into something that might possibly make some. Dad was always saying he'd made some small amount of money on the horses or on Miss World, but he never mentioned all the times he must have lost. In my first year at Falsley, when I was 11, columns of workers would file into the Harris Pie factory opposite as we were waiting on those steps. By my second year, the factory had closed down, and that was how it stayed, empty, argued over, six floors of windows. The kids from John Bentley, the local comprehensive school, the state school, no uniforms, walked past us every morning. We'd get gobbed at, grabbed and slammed against the doors of the town hall, called out, get bits of food thrown at us. Fesley itself wasn't much of a village. There was nothing there really except the school. The building was an Edwardian mansion with large windows at the front and gravel drives and playing fields. Imagine the sound of lots of kids' feet walking on gravel and then on polished wooden floors. Chemistry and physics were in a wooden lab down a smelly corridor that must have once been the stables. Biology was out in what must have once been the servants' quarters toward the woods. Maths was in what would have once been a guest bedroom. French and history were in the polished depths at the centre of all the stairs near the staff room, the heart of the building, where the corridor smelt of cigarettes and soup. For PE, we went down the stairs into the cellars, all dust and moss. Bits of the school kept falling off. We were standing outside in lines at the end of break once when a gargoyle cracked from the gutter and fell. It was falling towards Mr. Rowe, the ship headmaster, who was standing in front of us. There was one hopeful breath in from all of us as it dropped. Mr. Rowe was sure of everything. This will be the year in which 85% of you get an A grade at O level. It didn't sound like an order or a challenge, but like he already knew. But much of what he said turned out to be wide of the mark. The only way to deal with children, he once told my dad at a parents' evening, is to be certain. Deb told me the same evening certain school fees are going to go up, he said. The gargoyle shattered a few feet away from Mr. Rove. He glanced at it, then turned back to us without mentioning it. There were the woods at the back. They were surrounded by a long stone wall which we ran alongside when we were sent on cross-country runs. The woods were a sprint back to the bell at the end of break. The soil there was what got put into boxes and sifted on biology field trips. It was one of the two places where you smoked. If you did that, I didn't. In front of the school buildings, there was an old oak, the big tree. It had large, low, horizontal branches you could walk along or sit along like girls did. The bark was polished smooth by bodies. There were initials and patterns carved so deep into the wood they must have been there for years, the tree growing around the gashes, kept there by finger after finger pressing in. Every now and then, I'll ask people if they have impossible memories of their childhoods. Sometimes someone will recall seeing fairies, or an imaginary friend they were sure they saw and heard. Nothing I've been told matches what I remember. My name is Andrew Wagoner. At school, like most of us boys, I was known only by my surname. But there was also someone else. He was called Wagoner too. Wagoner was someone else. But he also had my name, and my face, and my place in the world. Jeans, smoking, writing stuff in your bag, wearing your shirt out, wearing your collar up, wearing your tie thin. I didn't do any of those things. Wagoner did. Wagoner also did some terrible things. It's going to be difficult, but I'm going to try to tell you something that's true. And that's the start. And I just wanted to read a little bit from A Long Way Further On, which gives you, if you like, the other side of the book. The extract of the book that's available on Tor.com does that initial opening and then goes on two more chapters to the inciting act of horrific bloody violence, which I thought I'd spare you this evening. The other side of the book is in the person of Angie Bowden, who is a girl from Wagoner's class that he never really quite gets to know. The curtains of Angie's room were half drawn. There was a bed that I looked at and then didn't. She also had a sink. It took me a moment to realise Wagoner wasn't beside me. I looked back to the doorway. He was standing in the hall, trying not to look angry. Around the doorway were blue tack sheets of paper. I went to look. I recognised song lyrics. Wagoner glowered for a moment more, then walked away. "Close the door," said Angie. Since she was sitting at her dressing table wearing jeans and a baggy black jumper. "You can sit on the bed." I did. It gave slightly beneath me. I put my feet firmly on the floor. On the ceiling was a piece of bright blue glossy paper, like a window to a blue sky. On it were smash hit stickers. There was Bananarama in the middle, a ring of 12 others around them, Spandau Ballet, Wham, Eurythmics, Duran Duran, Heaven 17, Tracy Ullman, Joe Boxer, Zizou, Pearl Star, Paul Young, New Order, UB40. The paper looked ragged, like the stickers had been replaced many times. "Bananarama," I asked. I couldn't help it. This list was so utterly divorced from anything Drake's lot could like. If Drake ever lay on this bed, he'd spend the next hour taking the piss out of Angie, probably. Hopefully. "Bananarama." She stood up, and for one horrifying moment I thought she was going to sit beside me, but instead she went to the window. Somehow, they seemed to know. When they were on Swap Shop, I wanted to call them up and ask. Curran, the young one. Sarah, a bit serious. Siobhan, it's her group, she's in charge. They're missing someone. There should really be a secret fourth member, or one we only hear about later. If I called up, Siobhan would understand what I was saying. She'd want to keep me on the phone and take down my number so we could talk more later. But she couldn't do that, because they wouldn't have let me give out my phone number on live TV, so in the end I didn't call. She was different here, still serious, but calm. Mum and Dad think I'm a bit mental. They keep sending me to see doctors and keeping me out of stuff at school, but I'm all right, I have my stuff. It's the school that's wrong. "Yeah," I said. Then I found I was nodding violently. "Yeah. We're meant to think the school building is historic and epic and everything, but it just looks shoddy to me. The future's better than the past, or what's the point?" She went and sat on the stool in front of the mirror on her dressing table and beckoned me over. "Here's where I asked the questions." So this was the mirror. It was indeed warped and cracked, a jagged line ran right across the centre. The mirror had spaces for pictures in the frame all around the glass, and in those gaps, Angie had spotted images of loads of pop stars, more than one in each gap, crowding in. That's everyone I could find a sticker of who's ever had a number one. I think you putting in them in there from years back was why it started answering me the way it does. I started doing it because it worked in fairy tales, and then I realised that three times in a row, the questions were answered by the title of the next number one single. The question I asked this week, if you're wondering, was about who most hated me. Turns out it's who I thought it was, the candy girl, Louise. You know, she gives out all that stuff from cooking. She says she hates everything about me now. I don't talk about serious things, apparently. I'm being distracted. I think she's gone weird like a lot of things have gone weird. But you want to know about the number one before that. You want to know what's true. I nodded again. I asked the mirror what you were. I must have looked astonished because she burst out laughing. So I've decided you're weird like I'm weird and not weird like Scorn and Louise have got weird. I wanted to say that she'd made a very dangerous assumption. I could think of another way I might be true, that my story was true, not my friendship, that she should listen if I told her about Wagoner and what had made him, what Drake had done to me. The mirror had a limited vocabulary. To really answer her question would have required such a prog rock title that it could never be a number one single. Pop music, she said, can change everything. Take you away, tell you what people are really like, let you see the future. It can take you from being one thing and make you into another. I had only ever danced the once in public. It had felt like that. You can draw on it when you need to using the words. I say them under my breath or write them down hidden on me to try and make things happen. Only the most current stuff, what I think will be in the charts next week. I think it lets me see a bit ahead because I'm trying to live in the future. That's the kind of other side of it.
The Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly podcast produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy174. We'd like to thank the famous Royal Navy volunteer for providing us with a venue, and we'd like to thank you for listening. If you would like to keep up to date with our events, please like our Bristol Con Fringe page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at BrizConFringe.